Hello, and welcome to Stardust Records, a Star Wars podcast. I'm your host, Linz, and though Sabi is unable to join us this week, we do have our dear friend Alden joining today to discuss episode 3 of The Acolyte. Welcome, Alden.
Hello, how are you, my friend?
I'm pretty good, and how about you?
I'm doing okay. I wonder where could Sabi be? I wonder if it's important.
I think it is. I think she is enjoying a lot of sun and sand, and I'm very happy for her.
Is she in Niamos or something? Something close to that.
An equivalent, I believe. Yes. So, though we mourn her absence, we also rejoice in her blissful vacation she's on.
Yes, absolutely. But thank you for having me to talk about this show in particular, something that is extremely heavy. And, you know, we talked a little bit before off air about how this is one of like the richest rewatch shows already, that when you sit down with it without the opening day anxiety, because I think part of like new Star Wars television is the, oh my God, okay. And you're like sitting down and you got to make sure everyone's quiet, and in your case, make sure there's not like 80 animals outside, you know, all making noise while you're trying to watch it. And so the rewatch is like, okay, I'm calm. I can't be surprised. I can actually enjoy performances, costumes, you know, little creatures, details. So it's exciting.
Yeah. And yeah, like I said, I watched it again yesterday and I was picking up on things that kind of subliminally were going on in my brain, and I kind of picked up on the first watch, but watching it again, I was like, oh, whoa, okay, there really is something I missed here, but we're missing it on purpose. Like, especially for this episode, this was a flashback episode that takes us back 16 years into the past to Brendok, the planet of Brendok, where Osha and May come from, and we get to see the sequence of events that led to what we see now in the future, and kind of fill in the blanks about why May is seeking out these Jedi and killing them. And yeah, so what did you feel about kind of taking this step back and stepping into this flashback? Because I'm trying to think of like when we've seen a flashback sort of thing like this in Star Wars, and nothing's coming to mind immediately, besides Andor, where we've got flashbacks of Cassian, and it was done very well in that. But what did you feel about this flashback episode being the core, the only part of this episode? We didn't get any flash forwards back to the future.
No, totally. There was a feeling of going into this episode, not knowing what Disney Plus is going to deliver, knowing that there would be heavy flashback in the show, just because if you're a fan like we are that obsesses over trailer footage and everything, you're like, hey, they have different hair. Hey. So it was inevitable, but I'm glad you pointed out, you know, the history of Star Wars flashbacks, because it is very small. And you pointed out Andor, which is a great almost counter to this. And what I mean by that is the Andor flashbacks, you can trust. The show is never in Andor, you know, it is not trying to say, well, it might have happened this way, or you might not have the. No, you have the full story. You know about Cassian's childhood. You know about his sister. You know about Marva and Clem. Like, you know, the little flashes back to like Clem's, you know, advice, you know, in the finale in Rick's Road. Like, that is what Clem said. And the narrative is giving us that. What Leslie's doing is what Rian Johnson did in The Last Jedi. And that was the first time we ever got flashbacks in Star Wars proper. You know, Star Wars would fill you in a lot about things that happened, but you never saw them until the Luke and Ben Solo Hutt flashbacks. Very intentionally, both Rian and Leslie Headlin cite Kurosawa's Rashomon as an influence. And Rashomon is a movie all about perspective. Did you have the full story? Are you seeing everything? What are the points of views? And of course, as you know, people listening to this show know, if you haven't seen The Last Jedi and you're listening to this show, I will be stunned. Please let us know if you're like, I'm discovering Star Wars for the first time. That would be very cool to start with this show. That would be very interesting. But in, you know, of course, it's Ben's version is very, very unforgiving of Luke and paints him as very murderous and scary. Luke's first version of the story is way more like, oh, he kind of freaked out on me, you know? And then there's what we can generally accept as the truth, which is somewhere in the middle. You know, Leslie going to that for this is extremely interesting because we're spending most of it with Osha, and the titles of the show have been two word titles so far, blank slash blank. This is not, this is just one. And there's even a, hey, May, take a walk. Like, literally, I think that's what they tell her, go for a walk or something. Like, so she's gone. We are with Master Soul way more than Telnaka, Torben, or Indara. And there are moments of aftermath of carnage, but not necessarily the carnage itself. There are moments of talking about the elements of the witchcraft, the previous machinations, like, you know, I created her. Well, I carried her. Well, you know, what, wait until they find out how you created her. Like, things like that. It's like, okay, so I like you, but did you do something terrible to make those babies? Like, there's a lot of that going on.
And you kind of get this sense of desperation around this coven in the fact that these are their only children. They don't have any other children in their coven, and they have been exiled, chased off of whatever world they were on before this one. And I feel like Mother Anasea, she is a little bit more flexible, more empathetic to her children, particularly Osha. She has a different perspective, and she's the leader, so her word matters. But I feel like Mother Coral is on the defensive, and she might be a little bit jaded, and she is probably willing to do whatever it takes to preserve their children. And so I believe that Mother Coral and May, we're going to get their perspective next, perhaps May's perspective particularly, or I feel like we might get the Jedi's perspective, or a mix of both.
Yeah, or
But I think
everybody
that,
else. Yeah.
so I feel like it might be May, because I get the feeling that May was somewhere else, perhaps with Coral, or I mean, she walked away with her earlier, but
Yeah.
that something happened between May and Coral walking, going on a walk, and then May ending up at Osha's door alone. Obviously, something happened, but she just has such a switch of I'm gonna kill you,
Yeah, it's a huge escalation.
from being upset at May or Osha for wanting to leave and not understanding, to going the complete opposite direction and being like, I'm gonna kill you. And that just feels a little bit suspicious. I know May has been a more, she's shown to be a little bit more aggressive, but it just feels like a jump to go from, you know, the last
I
thing you
miss
see.
you and I don't want. Because it's motivated by fear, right? What's interesting about the twins in this show is that they are, I believe, eight-year-olds at this point. So they're eight, you know, very close to Anakin Skywalker's nine, and the Phantom Menace parallels are all over. I mean, Anasea's sort of, you know, I respect your wishes, and you know, and will I ever see you again? And like all that is straight up Phantom Menace. Yeah, beautiful stuff. But what I find is interesting about the girls is that it's almost like Leslie is taking, you know, what if we could take the classic, like, there's more out there for me, which is very Luke and very Rey and very Ezra and all of our young wizard heroes, and clashing that perspective against Anakin, you know, May, what made him different? It's like we have all of this Star Wars, and it's like, what is different between the classic I want to be more and where it went wrong? And then we have two kids, so let's do both, because everything that May is saying is extremely based in fear and in control and in paranoia and in want, and all of it understandable because it's an 8 year old. Of course they're afraid of change and afraid of losing their not just best friend, but sister, and not just sister, identical sister.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of what Yoda and that council point out with Anakin, like your thoughts dwell on your mother, are you this, that? And of course, we all know, perhaps not handled the best. But we could see exactly what they meant happening here in real time. And so, yeah, I love that you pointed out, like, what is that change? Is it maybe they went for this walk and Coral said, they're gonna turn your sister into something and you won't recognize her, and Mama's making a mistake and
Yeah.
getting in her mind? Or is it even more sinister? Is Darth Smiles, Darth Teeth, Darth Teefs, as some are calling him, is he already lurking? Because he has, if you are a Chimera is the Sith theorist, and I'm sort of not predicting any one thing on that. Chimera meets Osha and says, "You look just like her," and like that's a little sinister. The fact that she has clearly been trained by this guy and has her dark side abilities sort of amped up by the present. Like, I have to wonder with all of this, and it ties in with, our ending. When Sol's getting little Osha out of there, they walk past all these dead witches. Those are not burned witches. And I almost wonder if the Sith Lord is watching all of like this 2 days and is kind of like, if I killed just one witch, this situation would probably pop off. They already want a fight. Like,
Yeah.
it feels like, yeah, she started this fire, sure, at the door. But why is the generator or whatever in the middle of this facility exploding? Like,
Yeah.
things are not adding up. And it's one of those things where when this season's over and we go back to this, we're going to be like, oh my God, wow, that episode was so much smarter than I even knew.
Yeah, I believe it's probably something to that effect, and I do think that we haven't seen the full power of Coral, Mother Coral. I do think that she's going to have a pretty heavy hand in whatever is revealed to us come these next coming episodes. And I think that, I don't know, I think I'm going to offer a counterpoint to your theory that the Sith Lord or the Acolyte or whatever he is has his hand in this situation. I almost wonder if he doesn't. And because we see Mei at the end alone at the tree, the Boonta tree, I wonder if she's found. So maybe this is my thought. Maybe this acolyte, the Sith entity, is aware of this coven because they do practice darker force abilities. And comes to check in on it and finds everybody dead, and Mei is there. So he takes Mei in and trains her up and says, okay, now here is your final test to prove yourself to me. You need to take vengeance. And this is how you have to do it when she like comes of age. That's my thought on that. So I think he might be around, but maybe not
Less
have his hand
directly.
at this point.
Yeah,
Because,
totally. Like, when are they making their move is sort of, I mean, it's sort of the whole conceit of the show is, like, when in a pre-Phantom Menace time are they bold enough to get involved at all?
And I do think that even if he wasn't present while the Jedi are there on this planet, we know that the Sith are very crafty. How did the Jedi know that this coven was there? This is apparently not Republic space. Who tipped them off that these children were there?
Exactly.
We know
One
Palpatine
one concern
has,
call.
yeah, we know Palpatine has done stuff like this, and obviously Palpatine's not around right now, but it's a very Sith-like thing to do to tip people off and point the Jedi in directions that kind of snowball. And I could see that being a possibility, the Sith meddling in that way, because. And that kind of leads me into a question I have for you is what did you feel about the Jedi's involvement in this? How they approached it? What did you feel about it? 'Cause I like how messy it was. I don't feel that the Jedi are infallible, but I also don't think that they deserve like a lot of hate for how this all went. So I love kind of the murkiness of it all, but you let me know. What did you think about it?
I'm with you. I will start by saying I'm with you on I love the murkiness and I love that it's not cut and dry. My first gut thing, the very first thing I tweeted on Twitter, because that's what it's called, is that this episode doesn't let anyone off the hook. And I think there's a difference between doing that and playing both sides. Both sides to me is the, I would say, sillier instinct that maybe some of the old EU had. Like there was a point in like the old EU where they would be like, oh, well, you can use Force Lightning, but like you can use it for good. And it's like, no, you can't. Like that's the point. You're missing the metaphor. Like you can't do these things for good. You can't be force choking people for good. That gets silly. But I think there's an elegant way to, and I think the show succeeds at this, criticize two institutions and two groups that are both coming from a place of we just want to do what's best for these children and for the future and for the Force. We're not, you know, it's less sinister than, say, a Path of the Open Hand, who they were actively being run by a megalomaniac who had her own designs and conned them. Like that's a little bit different. But you could see the shades for sure of how maybe that would have trickled. I think it's very classy in that it doesn't fall into the trap that I think a lot of fans maybe fall into, which is like, well, the Jedi are actually the bad guys and they're running around taking children. That is not accurate. And, you know, if, and if you're listening to this and you've said anything like that, it's not personal. But we have had the prequels now since 2005, you know, when they ended, for those keeping score at home. And in that time, it's become very in vogue amongst Star Wars aficionados to say, well, the Jedi actually suck, and the Jedi are actually bad, and the Jedi are actually this. And it's like, well, no, the point is that they are good, but George was trying to tell us, look at how a good thing can still fall. Look at how a good thing can still be taken advantage of, how they can still lose their way. He's on the record saying they're still the most moral people of the Clone Wars era. And that's true. Even if you're like, Count Dooku had some good points. Look at the people that he put on his council. You know, you would not want to side with Wat Tambor and all those guys. So it's like, it is still good. You're not going to look at me and tell me that Obi-Wan Kenobi is aiding and abetting child trafficking. So it's like, it gets a little bit out of control sometimes. And I think this episode reined it in a smart way by, I think, choosing great leaders. I think Sol and Anasaya are very much, you know, if not parallels, but they connect on the level of we're not trying to turn this into a violent situation. We are trying to talk it out, and we are trying to value what this young girl wants. We are asking, we're literally kneeling and coming down to her level, and wanting to look her in the eye and listen to her, because little kids are still people. They're still individuals. But then you have their number twos. You have Coral, you have Indara, who are both much colder. And yeah, Indara should be criticized a lot, I think, for the, well, you know, we have the right to test and do this with your permission, of course, which is so passive aggressive. But, and I get it, people heard that line and they were like, F the Jedi, I get it. But lest we forget, they did immediately sic the dark side on Torben for just standing there. He hadn't done anything except be like, hello. Like, they immediately did that to him. And it's, again, not, it's not a, oh, both sides, because obviously these witches have been persecuted. But again, this is one of those things where it's like, we might right now be like, oh, the witches. But like, what if they had to like sacrifice a bunch of people to do this ritual to create these children? I don't know. It could
Yeah,
all come out.
we don't have the full story here yet, and I also think that it could come to a point where we can't pick a side, and I wouldn't want to pick a side. Not to both sides it, but just say like, you have to weigh every factor. You have to weigh every, it's like the Jedi broke into their fortress for this first confrontation. They didn't come to the door and say, "Hello, we're here. Can we please talk to you?" They broke in and crashed their ceremony.
Not great.
Wasn't very diplomatic of them, but then maybe they were also very concerned for the children. They didn't know what was about to happen to them. They thought that they needed to come in and make themselves known, because what if these witches were going to do some sort of dark side ritual on them that, you know, hurts them in the end or
Which is
whatever. So
like
it's like,
objectively, and that's the thing, is that like we're the viewer, so we have the God's eye of being able to see everybody, but like it is hard, I think, sometimes in like the fan discourse to talk about what the Jedi are doing wrong because they are out of their jurisdiction and everything. But like you pointed out, Sith involvement or otherwise, any tip of like, if you're walking down the road and this is not the town you live in, and someone says, "Hey, they might be keeping a kid in that cabin," like there's a part of your soul that will tug at you to say, "I need to say something at the very least about that cabin." And so, again, the Jedi are a good thing, but what are they doing wrong? Maybe be less concerned with tests and more concerned with like, "Hey, we have camp over there. Why don't we all have a meal? Why don't we all?" It's the rushing to, "Well, we have the right to test and you don't." And on the witch's side, they're meeting right after the Jedi are like, "All right, we'll see you tomorrow." Poral's like, "There's only four of them. We could kill them all." Like, that's like, okay, well, you're not great at diplomacy. That's not advisable. And so, yeah, it's not at both sides. It's a, people will make suboptimal decisions sometimes in the same direction, and they don't align. They can't align. It doesn't make anybody Sith. It doesn't make anybody bad. It just means, like Anasea said, who has the right is a huge question for power and for other things. And yeah, you can see sort of the cracks. But of course, they grabbed Torben's brain, blackened his eyes, and made him all dark. And Sol didn't strike anyone down. He pulled out the saber almost as if to say, "I could, but look at how I'm gonna treat your kid. I'm gonna be kind." And if everyone was like, "Soul, we'd be fine."
Exactly.
But
And it makes me think about how different Jedi through the ages have approached certain situations. We know Obi-Wan Kenobi was very diplomatic, but he was, ready to stand firm when he needed to, but a lot of times he tried to negotiate his way out of situations or into situations. And then also Loden Greatstorm from the High Republic, he had a really, I think it was in the Tales of Light and Life. I think that was the one it was in, but he was showing Bell how to get through to people and change people in an empathetic way. They lived with these people for a while. They helped them. They changed one village from being warring to being peaceful. And, I think if I recall correctly, Bell's like, is this gonna, there's thoughts of, is this gonna actually change this planet? And, when we leave. And Loden's like, we helped these people, and now they have the tools to help their people and the other people on this planet, and that's all we can do. And so it just makes me think, Loden, Obi-Wan, other Jedi that we know who approach certain situations with more tact and empathy versus Indara in this specific situation, or Anakin. You know what I'm saying? Like the and but I love that. I love that the Jedi aren't just one thing. They're many things, and they all see the Force differently. And I love that we're getting this sort of cross section of them, and we're showing, like, yes, the Jedi Order is great, and like you're saying, they do good things, but these are still people. These are still people, and people are going to do what people are going to do, and they're going to approach things all sorts of different ways. And so I love that they showed that even in just that one scene, particularly where they confront the coven for the first time. I was very impressed with that.
I like that you said that the Jedi aren't monolithic, because I think that's a huge point of what the show is trying to say. I mean, there's the whole, there's the Sol and Indara that are the two more prominent perspectives, but you also have sort of the like toned back sort of Kel Naka perspective, where even though he's not speaking basic, and so it's not dialogue scenes, he's very much like, "I'm gonna step back, I'm gonna observe." He's the one that susses out that the kids are there. But again, he's not going for his sword. He's just like, in a Wookiee way, like, all right, stop lying. Don't lie. We know the kids are here, you know, and later on has that little moment of kind of meeting Osha properly by his speeder bike. And so you can see sort of the range of coldness, but also tenderness in the Jedi, but and in the witches as well, you know, spice creams and things like that. Like, you know, are we going to allow them to be kids, to be curious? I think in terms of the witches, you know, being contrasted against the Jedi Order in terms of childhood, you mentioned it earlier, they are the only kids there, which is a point of suspicion because these two witches that are, you know, tending to them are kind of like, oh no, they are aware of that, and that's above our pay grade. So there's that. You know, later Sol is like, I love the scene where he's like, you know, I was selected when I was only four, and there's thousands of kids, and you know, and it made me think of Obi-Wan saying like to little Leia, like, you know, I think I had a brother, but then, you know, I have a new family, and like that was really sweet. And how does it contrast against these witches that don't let them out to see the planet, don't want them doing X, Y, and Z, don't want them to know certain things, don't want them to know their own origins? It's kind of like, again, the love that these moms have for their girls is indisputable and is beautiful and is beautifully acted too. But it's like, you know, the Jedi are making almost like better macro decisions, like light and life, you know, yes, you know, we all have this big community at this time and thousands of people and all these different ways of being and these different outposts, and like that's great, but personally are kind of goofing it, and the witches are kind of the inverse, where it's like personally they might care and are doing their best, but you're also holed up in a fortress kind of indoctrinating them. But then people very quickly would be like, well, isn't what the Jedi do indoctrinate? And to that, I don't have an answer. Exactly.
Yeah, it all goes back to these children being extraordinary, and who has the right to speak into their lives and influence them, and what is the right way to do so. You know, the Jedi are you know, generally the more right way in terms of morality and empathy and caring for others and, you know, not wishing death and destruction on anyone. And but there's these, I won't say shades of gray, because a lot of people will think of gray Jedi, and I don't know what I think about that. I don't know if I ascribe to that, but obviously the Force is in other cultures and other societies, as we see with this coven, we see with the Dathomir, you know, witches, the Night Sisters. So I kind of wanted to talk about that a little bit with the thread. And their sort of, what do you call it? Their mantra, I suppose, of the power of one, the power of two, the power of many. And it was when I was first watching this episode, when Mother Anasea was talking about the thread and explaining it and also demonstrating it, it made me think about how you once talked about how Star Wars is kind of like a tapestry. And I was like, oh, Alden. But we're
Oh
talking
yeah,
about the Force.
they owe me a check on this one,
But
actually.
we're talking about the Force and how she, you know, threads, a thread alone, you know, only has a certain amount of strength. And when it's paired with another thread, it's a little stronger. And when there's many threads together, you've got something, you know, very strong, very powerful. And how Mother Anasea, near the end, when her and Osha are having their last conversation together, and she says, like, you can pull on this thread and see what happens, because it's your life and you can do this. But that, you know, I don't know if the word is allegory, or that, you know, when you pull a thread, you're pulling whatever that
Yeah,
thread,
the
you know, is
analogy,
attached to. The
the
analogy,
metaphor,
you're gonna unravel some things. You know, Osha is part of this coven, and when she pulls on her thread to leave, she's unraveling things inadvertently, but it's gonna happen. It's just because she's, you know, woven into this group of people. And so you know, we have to ask, was it OSHA that, you know, pulled this thread? It's not her fault, but, you know, these things happen and she made her choice, and we
Yeah.
see what comes of not just her choice, but obviously we know May is probably making a choice. Mother Coral's making a choice. Mother Anasea made a choice in letting OSHA make her choice. So going back around again, what did you feel about the way that the Force is described in this coven, in this culture?
I've really loved the way that modern Star Wars has expanded on this whenever it can. Not, you know, there's not a lot of opportunity necessarily, especially, you know, you got a movie, it's a 2-hour movie. 9 of the 12 films are in a story of a family, so it's like it's not going to come up that much. Rogue One, you know, was sort of the first, like, hey, this is a different group, and like, yeah, they're not the main characters, but you get a little bit of exploration, you know, with the way that Chirrut describes how he can perceive that something will kill something. He's not a Force user, but there's that, you know, I don't have to tell you, of course, this being one of the most Rogue One, most passionate Rogue One fans that I know on this show, you and Savi, how the Force moves, very basic movement for Chirrut. Whether that's true of all the Guardians of the Wills is for future stories. You know, they're expanding them whenever they can. There was the people that observe the Force, like the Tide in like the Legends of Luke Skywalker, how, you know, they are seeing it that way. Very Elzar Mann of them to make like that ocean connection. And the High Republic has done that on an individual basis all throughout. And then on the basis of like the convocation of the Force in phase two, and like how they used to have whole meetings about this on Jedha constantly. And yeah, it would break out into arguments and people getting kicked out. And I wonder what in real life could have inspired something like that.
Oh, I wonder.
crazy to think that people would fight over these things. But in terms of this one, I love it because it's kind of like metatextual, because yes, threads, literally mystically for them, you know, that's even how she first sort of physically summons her Force power, is in that people can't see me, but I'm doing the vertical, like pinching it, like pulling it. And then, you know, does Force push, Force pull, like kind of the abilities that we recognize. But also metatextually, and, you know, for us, threads are also of a story, like the story threads. Like she's effectively telling OSHA, if you choose to, you know, level up from side character to main character here, if you choose to break away from this and begin, it's almost like looking into the camera and saying, if she does this, she will begin the hero's journey, you know, and like that
yeah.
is sort of what's happening. And I loved it on that level, that there are these people not necessarily perceiving the Force as amorphous as the Jedi. The Jedi, you know, it, as we all know, binds us, penetrates us, blah, blah, blah. And this is a little bit more active. It's a little bit more active, but also a little bit more cautious at the same time. There's a lot of push and pull, you know, between what's happening. Because you could make the argument that this talk of, if you pull on this thread, is effectively the same as Obi-Wan's, you know, you've taken your first step into a larger, like, it is the same. The witches are looking at it with a little bit more gravity. Like, if you do this X, Y, and Z, and you will have effectively changed our whole ball of yarn. Whereas the Jedi are like, you take your first step, it's already in you. They're trying to be a little bit more, you know, go with the flow about it.
We kind of touched on this earlier. This group feels very reminiscent of the Path of the Open Hand, but also very reminiscent of the Dathomir Night Sisters, but very much its own thing. And I really love that. I really feel like they struck a perfect balance between not feeling too familiar, but not being so alien that people can't be like, what is this? This is so out of the realm of anything we've ever seen before. I feel like it struck just the perfect balance there. I know some people probably don't feel that way, but I feel that way. I feel like this was the perfect sort of middle ground between what we've seen before without feeling like it's a copy paste.
Yeah, I think, you know, you're right. There's the obvious sort of, and I think Leslie actually spoke about this in an interview. There she was talking about, like, discussing the era and discussing the Force lore of the time with Dave Filoni, and how Dave was the one that was like, well, you know, like there's nothing that says that all witches are Night Sisters. And she was like, you're right. What, like, what if there are other witches? Thank you. Like, and how just that little suggestion kind of opens it up, because yeah, the idea of a coven will obviously evoke that. But the Night Sisters, what I like is that this comes from something different. It's like, it's sort of like kind of what I'm sure I'm not alone in this, but I've wished for, you know, oh, what if Caltrain Marin was a big thing that I've been on about. Like, before Survivor, I was like, oh, I want to play as Marin so bad. What if in the gap of time, you know, obviously things went very differently for what ended up happening in the story, but post Fallen Order, I was like, oh, how cool would it be to see what a witch could do with the traditional Force? And I'm kind of getting that here, because the Night Sisters, it comes from the ichor of Dathomir. It is a very different, like, we are pulling from home. We are pulling from specific things. We're not pulling outwardly from the cosmic force in. But this is that. So that their ritual is even, you know, beneath these gorgeous, by the way. I love that shot of like the vertical planets lining up and all that. So it is sort of that. Like, I don't get the idea that there's anything really like overtly special about Rendok force-wise. It's got the tree that plays into the poison later and all that. But yeah, the Night Sisters, it's like, that's something way more eldritch, way more arcane, a little monstrous, a little bit more inherently sinister. It's like you line up their powers and it's like, it's definitely not great. Like, even though there are Night Sisters who are wonderful, of course, it's like, what are your abilities? Oh, we can make swords out of fire. We can raise the undead.
Raise the dead.
Yeah, like we can take someone like Savage Opress and just give him dark side force powers. Like, it ain't great. This is sort of like, yeah, there are covens who are also just kind of, they are force pull, force push, what we know, but philosophically different. And so it ends up being in that middle. And, you know, you mentioned the path. It's almost like, you know, the path at this point, path proper would have been, so it's 100 back to phase three and then another 150 back. So 250-ish years before the path were doing what they were doing. They were killing Jedi. They had the access to the Nameless, and things were going 0 to 100. You know, the path went from being like these weirdos who gave flowers out in town, but like ultimately didn't really cause much trouble, and so people looked the other way, to, oh my God, Night of Sorrow, everything's horrible. Like, so this ain't that, but you get the idea. Like, I just feel like, okay, here's the best way I can word it. I just rambled just to get to this. It feels like, and this is something else we can talk about, I'm sure, in the same way that fans are like excited now, like, oh, does Plagueis know about this coven? Is he building on their research? Different conversation. I feel like this coven probably, if not connected to the path, has definitely read the literature. They're like, that's an interesting point. Kind of went sideways with that Night of Sorrow, but we should write that stuff down.
The beginning of Mother Anisea's explanation of the thread, she made a comment to the effect of, like, some people use the Force. Mm-hmm. I think the Force is to be used.
Yeah.
She kind of just left it there, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Other people think differently than us, but this is how we believe.
Right.
And you know, we're not trying to take from the Force, not trying to use it in that way. That particularly made me think of the path and how they were against the Jedi using the Force and taking from the Force. Mm-hmm. All in all, I kind of circling back around to kind of where we began talking about missing, we're not getting the full picture. We're missing some scenes. We have an unreliable narrator. We're only looking at Osha's perspective at this point, really. And we might get May next time. I feel like there was a few spots in Osha's perspective in this episode when everything was going crazy where I was like, oh, that's going to be something that we see more of. We're going to see the other side of. And particularly when Osha escapes from her burning room and is suddenly going through a hallway or a tunnel, and then there's that grate above her, and there's, you know, an explosion or something happens up there, and, you know, screaming, and then she keeps running. And it's like, okay, that whatever that was up there was probably all those witches meeting an end, and probably whatever happened in that courtyard. And I thought the way that that scene was cut was really suspicious too, just how it's like she escapes from the room, suddenly she's in this tunnel, that happens, and all of a sudden she's now in this reactor
It's
room,
very
and
jarring.
it all
Yeah.
happens so quickly, but it comes from the perspective of a child, an 8-year-old child going through something very traumatic, and maybe she can't remember everything perfectly. That's kind of how it came across to me, and I really liked that, and I got more of that in the second viewing. It became more obvious to me. And
Yeah, it's
so,
like
yeah.
disorienting. It's a little bit unnerving. You're sort of like you're trying to empathize with her, especially like bringing us down to her level. Like there are moments where you're like, oh, I felt like that pull of like, okay, I'm in a children's adventure right now. Like when she's picking at the thing to get into the little, okay, I can crawl through here. But then there's also this like constant like, oh my God, what are the adults doing? Are the adults ruining everything? Like the episode doesn't let you settle. I think that's very intentionally directed by Kogonada, who I think is a perfect fit for Star Wars. Like this felt like this someone is someone who gets Star Wars. But the yeah, like it's almost like this episode wants you to like, okay, like, hey, look at what the child is doing, but you never stop thinking about hypocrisy and about what could be going on. It doesn't, it's like action that is understated, but feels so devastating. Like there's no lightsabers drawn that we see. And I'm sure we'll get there. There's no dark side versus light side force battle. There's no anything, but I just felt so much dread even in those abrupt cuts. And so much of it is about what we don't see. I mean, even thematically, like to tie it back to your previous point about, her saying at that beginning of that lesson, there are people that think that they can use it, but like, that's not what we do, and it's like really because there's a conversation in about 10 minutes where your wife says you definitely did do something that you shouldn't have done to literally make the girls that you are talking to. And so a lot of this is about truth, and it's about what adult will finally say the thing that needs to be said. And knowing, not starting the show here but starting it in the present and giving this as flashback, it's like we can watch these adults telling half truths, lying, skirting around corners, trying to protect their reputations, and affirm their own beliefs. And where did that lead us? To somebody killing themselves, willingly killing themselves, rather than face the shame that couldn't deal with it. And so it's like we're watching, we know like what this got us. It got us a murderous rampage. It got us a suicide. It got us Kelnaka essentially in exile, it looks like. And all of that hangs over the episode, especially the fact that we all know, yes, we're proud of Osha for standing up for what she wants, and we're proud of her for affirming herself. And to tie it into truth versus lies, we're proud of her for being the only one that stands by the truth in this episode. She won't lie on this test. And Sol points that out, like how important the truth is. But we also know in our hearts and minds, this doesn't work out for her either. She quits. We don't know that story yet. We know it had something to do with Indara, that Indara, or at least Indara said, yeah, you should quit. But so that's hanging over everything too, is that like you can see her trying to run away from this fire and trying to get out of here, but it's like you're gonna end up a mechnik, which you seem to enjoy. That's fine. That's a great life too, but and that's your own path. But you're not going to find home with any of these people. And that is sad. And it makes the moments like her Phantom Menace cup ship speeder, which with Lothcat this time in the test, it makes things like that more sad. And I love the way that they played that of like Sol just saying correct until she would get frustrated enough to give herself away and deal with a child. But it's sad. It's it's doing what Phantom Menace does to us emotionally, where it's like you can cheer for Anakin to win that pod race, but you know where he's going.
Yeah, it's a somber experience because even if you're like, oh, she made it out, like, she's now going to be on her path, but she lost these people, but surely can it can get better from here. But we know, like you said, we know what happens in the future. And so I guess we could just only root for what happens from here on in the future, and hopefully things turn out well for them in the end. So speaking of the end, do we have any other final thoughts or things we want to bring up about the end of this episode or any point in this episode that, because we kind of jumped around.
I think this episode is one of those ones where you end up jumping around because it's there are some episodes of Star Wars television, particularly like Mandalorian or even Ahsoka to a certain degree, that it's like it's so questy, it's so classic myth, it's so Lord of the Ringsy that it's like I know what to talk about in order because I, like Din Djarin, would also just walk through Star Wars and like from one place to another. Whereas this is so disorienting that like coming out of it, I was like, oh, okay. But yeah, like there, things we didn't touch on. Like, I mean, the song is great. I love the ceremony. I love the way it's portrayed. Like that's the thing is like we're talking about ideas, but when you start to boil it down to the stuff we'll salivate over, that visual dictionary, soundtrack, costumes, like the I love first of all, I love that old lady.
She reminded me of, is it old Dhaka
Old Dhaka, yeah.
from the Dathomir Night Sister? She was the old crone. She reminded me of her the moment I saw her. I was like, hey.
Loved that.
But
Yeah.
yeah, she was really cool. And they had a Twi'lek as a part of their coven. She was really neat. I liked that very small slice of life sort of scene where the girls are running in and you kind of see the coven going about its day. And you brought this up before, we get the spice creams. And Star Wars released a recipe for that. So if you guys want to go
Oh,
and try it
already?
out,
Okay,
there's a
cool.
recipe release. So if you
Nice.
were watching the episode and you thought, man, I wonder what a spice cream would taste like, StarWars.com did release a
Nice.
recipe. But yeah, that I love those little domestic sort of touchstones to kind of make you feel for these characters. They're not just bold heroes with, they never sleep, they never eat. Like, we get to kind of experience life with them. And I love when we get those little moments, with the spice creams, with the within Andor we see Cassian take a shower, like,
Yeah.
just stuff like that really connects you to
It's
the
important. Yeah.
characters.
It's very important. And like, I talked about sort of what you have time to do in a film versus what you have time to do in television. And we've been in the age of Star Wars television now for 5 years in November, which is crazy, that we've, or no, 6 years in November.
Oh, yeah.
Is that how it works?
I think
2019.
so.
And then, well,
Yeah.
yeah. Wow.
We're coming up
Lord.
on it.
That's crazy. Yeah, so that took me by surprise. But it's like if we're gonna do Star Wars TV, and now we've done a bunch of it, we should be doing stuff like that. Because in a film, it's like outside of New Hope, there isn't really time to ever slow down. Or if you do, it's always like tinged with like incoming tragedy, like Anakin and Padme having dinner is there to set up the difficult conversation they have to have about love and forbidden passion. But just like, yeah, Cassian, showering, or the Ferrix sort of like the bar, and the guys working and Brasso and like all that. Din Djarin just having soup, lifting up his helmet and having a little bit of soup or getting chowder for Grogu while he handles business. Like that's the type of stuff that you can do in television that lets things sit. Sabine feeding her cat. It's like I want to care about these places as much as I care about the people because when this fortress falls, I'll remember that. I don't know all these witches' names and I don't know all their stories and maybe down the road we will because it's a Star Wars, but it's not necessary right now. But I do need to see that it was a place where they had sweet treats. We got the phrase sweet treats in Star Wars, like sweet treats and doing the girls' hair and looking out for each other and emphasizing that, you know, two is greater than one, but all is greater than two. Like that collectivism is really, really important, and that's something that they share. And that almost makes it a little bit more tragic. Like, you know, the stuff between Sol and Anasea and how they have similar leadership styles, it kind of bleeds into everything, where it's like, you both are groups that emphasize collectivism. You both are groups dealing with children. You both are groups that know the forest in similar ways. And it's like, if you guys could just sit down and talk, you know, like that's the thing that I don't know if you watch much Doctor Who. I know we maybe talked about it a little bit off air, but the Peter Capaldi's 12th Doctor has this famous speech that he does in a story called the Zygon Invasion and Zygon Inversion. It's getting real nerdy on here right now. And he says, like, he's yelling at these two different sides. He's like, if you would just sit down and talk, like every single person, every war that has ever happened, every battle has ever happened, it's because people won't do this. And he's like, but you know, these two sides won't give in, and like they can't even really remember why they're angry at a certain point. And he tells one of them, then you will die stupid. Like, you know, he's like, do you know what this means, like to sit down and talk, like to think. It's just a fancy way to say changing your mind. It's so clear that people won't do that here, and that doesn't make any of them evil, but we've seen how it trickles down. Like, what is the fundamentally, I would love for fans like to really think about this when we get back to the present. Fundamentally, what's the difference between these people marching up on the witches and, you know, not attacking, but breaking in and then slowly walking in during their ceremony? What's the difference between that and the way that Yord is always saber first on every single issue? What's the difference between the way that they handled capturing May, which was extremely American police coded? Like, there is no difference, and it should be a little unnerving. My partner over on the other podcast I do anytime, Ken Knapsack, on his Star Wars show Force Center, he was saying the thing that people are that should realize about Yord is that Yord is right on paper, and but it's not great because Yord is the perfect prequel Jedi. And we always say, like, oh, if only Anakin had been born in the High Republic. Yord is the opposite of that. Yord
He
is
is that.
Yord's a Clone Wars Jedi born before his time, and it's not good.
He
And
needs to, hopefully he has an awakening, a little
oh,
bit
we
of
hope.
a kind of sand off some of those
Yeah.
sharp edges that he's got going on there. And I think he might,
I
because
hope so too.
he said that he was a knight for 2 years. He's been a knight for 2 years now, I think, at this point when we meet him. And if this is a time of peace, I have a feeling that knights aren't as, they don't have a lot of opportunity for a lot of experience like the
Yes.
knights did during the High Republic phase three, phase
Yeah.
one.
And that's
And then
so key.
also as the prequel, you know, like Jedi, like they're getting this time of peace and Yord is doing everything by the book and he's, you know, probably been on missions here or there, but like, has this man ever like faced a true moral dilemma, like a really hard situation? Has he ever like
Yeah.
had this experience? I don't know if he has yet.
And
I
that's
think he's
so
probably.
classically, like, when we look at the parts of the story that are like noir investigation, like that's a trope of those stories, is like fresh faced cop arriving in a dark city and he do things normal, and the cops there are like, no, you don't understand. Like, it's like when somebody shows up in a Batman story and they're new. It's like, nah, you don't get it, man. There's freaks here. Like, things are grim. And, you know, situationally, about, like you said about the Jedi, you can see both in the 16 years prior and in the 16 years now, these are not people used to dealing with pushback. Like, pushback from the witches. Now we'll see pushback from the Sith. They are what they call in House of the Dragon, they refer to those knights as the Knights of Summer. Because all they've been doing is tournaments and walking around looking cool, and there hasn't actually been a battle and a war in so long that they've just been procedural and sort of strutting around. Whereas, like, you can tell with Vernestra, she's like not cold, but a little bit more like tactful and methodical about things because she has literally battled space Vikings. But yeah, like, she's literally battled space Vikings. She has experience that no one else has. Like, you know, she's there's a little bit of the, and it's not a bad thing, I get it. But yeah, some fans that love these books, like we both do, there's been a little bit of like, oh, she seems so different. And it's like, yeah, big difference between 17 and 117. And it should make you feel weird. It should be a little sad, you know, not that she's tragic or anything. I mean, I hope not. I hope she has a great season and nothing bad happens to her. But
Yes.
it's like, you know, it's kind of like when Ahsoka showed up being a grown adult and meeting Grogu and Din, and people were like, why does she seem so cold? It's like, because life has been beating this woman down since she was a teenager. And so she has that perspective. And, you know, Leslie has said there's not going to be any more familiar faces like Yoda or sorry, Lindsay. I don't think we're going to see Yariel this season.
No.
although I would love Leslie so much more than I already do, which is already a very high bar. If she said that and then was like, I lied. Here's Yaddle. Here's Oppo. Here's, you know, like that would be great. But those are people that remember in a way that these Jedi don't. And so it's like even masters like Solan and Dara are humans. They're gonna be 80, 90 years old if they're lucky. And their perspective is extremely limited. And I think that's why the trailers for this have one Sith versus like 9 or 10 Jedi, and it looks like they're gonna lose that, you know, because the Sith have been in hiding, knowing there's gonna come a day where we're gonna kick some ass, and they have been prepared for that. Whereas the Jedi have said, man, boogeyman's, am I right? Crazy that there used to be Sith. Anyway, let's go patrol the streets. Like, they have not even thought that they would have to. And that's sort of the tragedy of where we're headed with the prequels and the Clone Wars, is that those Jedi Knights are, in a lot of ways, the all-star of Jedi Knights in terms of like being warriors. You've got Mace Windu and Anakin Skywalker and Obi-Wan Kenobi and Yoda and like all these people. But it's like it should never have had to become that. And it starts here with, you know, to, you know, people are probably like, oh, we're not talking about Acolyte anymore, but we still are. It is about Acolyte, because not being able to have these conversations with a coven is what gives any credence whatsoever to people like Count Dooku. What gives any credence whatsoever to people like Mother Talzin. It's what gives any credence whatsoever to people like, you know, the different critics that would pop up of the Jedi even further down the road, or like people not believing in them, and the constant like, we don't learn, so we fail, trickles all the way down to Luke and Rey. And it's like, finally, you know, maybe somebody will break this cycle. But to see it in real time with the time to sit in an episode is unnerving. This episode is much like, you know, I would say maybe like Andor announcement, or like some of the Narkina stuff, and one or two other Star Wars TV episodes, maybe an animation. This is one of the first Star Wars episodes where it's like, I didn't feel good watching it, but you're not supposed to. And it's so that's not a negative review. It's a very good review. That's it. You got me where I was like, it's like there are some things that like I could revisit any day. And this is one where I know a couple years from now, I'm like, oof, episode 3 of Acolyte. Like, that's a rough one.
That's a heavy one.
Yeah.
It's a heavy one, but I think it fits this show tonally, and it's necessary. I mean, obviously it is. They wouldn't do it if it wasn't, but it's definitely going to be necessary going forward in the story and giving us a perspective of these characters and adding more weight and importance to what they're doing. Because, you know, in the first and second episode, kind of get that, but we're also like, why the heck is May so angry? Why is she killing these people? Like, sure, something bad happened, but like, what happened? And so now we know part of the story. Yeah, it's exciting. This is an exciting time to be a Star Wars fan. I think it's always an exciting time to be a Star Wars fan, but particularly right now with this with the Acolyte being in this kind of interim phase between the High Republic and the prequels, giving us this view. Yeah, I love it.
I love it too. I'm extremely pleased. I'm intrigued. These have been the hardest wait times between episodes. Well, I say that, but then like I also was doing the same thing when live action Thrawn happened, and I was like, I need more. So it's like I'll probably end up saying this forever show, but I am, on the edge of my seat, needing to know what happens in both the present and the past, and wanting better for Mei. You know, Star Wars is largely about redemption. Will we see twins fighting side by side, like at some point? Like, I would love that. But at the same time, it's like,
I just
oh,
had
go
this
ahead.
vision. I just had this vision when you said side by side. There's that scene in this episode where Mother Inessa, tells them to guard, be on their guard, and Mei jumps in front of Osha to hold back the Force. And I'm wondering if we're gonna have a similar scene in
Switch.
the future.
Yeah,
That'd
because
be.
Osha in the present as a mechanic has lost her affinity. It's not that it's not there, but it's like not practicing, and the Force is not like a bike. It's quite the opposite. She can't even Force pull Pip in a situation like that. So it's like, if yeah, maybe if it's the Sith is gonna destroy Mei, because they always destroy each other. We know how it
Yeah.
goes. And that's what makes Osha go full Jedi again. If we,
Oh,
because
I
it's like,
hope so.
I would love that. And I also just like, my last thought would be, yeah, Mei is a little bit much in this episode. She is, running around saying, I'll kill you. Like, it's not great. And like, yeah, like siblings do crazy stuff all the time. Like, everyone that has a sibling has had that moment where you're like, I'll kill them. We've all been there. But where you're like, I hate my sibling. They are crazy. Whatever version of it is for you. But I also do fundamentally feel really terrible for her. And in the same way I do Anakin, but like right off the bat, like she like you have Osha saying, like, you always do stuff like this. Like when she holds the little animal, and it's like, yeah, that's not great. Like, that's not a good sign. It is, in fact, one of the first signs of not great things in our real world. When you look at a lot of these like true crime profiles, it is, very like sort of Voldemort-esque in that way. But at the same time, what if there had been just one tender mentor? What if there was one person that was like, hey, you don't get it. You can be really curious, and you can use your power, but let's do it this way. And it's like she just didn't have the guidance, and we're like, they're always treated as a pair, and Osha vocally is now pushing back on it. Mei is latching on to it, but not in a way that is healthy. Somebody needed to tell Mei, hey, and you're a special individual too,
Yeah.
and she doesn't get that. And if you don't get that affirmation, you end up killing people, I guess.
I guess so.
I guess.
Well, let's end on that and put a little pin in this conversation and we'll
Happy
revisit
stuff.
it. We'll revisit it. We will. So wrapping up, Alden. So Savi and I usually we ask all our guests this, and I don't remember if we I think we did ask you this. Our question is always, out of all the Star Wars characters, who would you shadow for a day? But we're gonna rein it in a little bit. Out of all these Acolyte characters, who would you like to hang out with for a day?
I would be extremely intrigued by a day with Kel Naka,
Oh.
because there's something about, I mean, the gentle giant archetype in general is always something that I enjoy. Because it's like Wookiees are one of the first things we ever knew about in Star Wars, and like one of the first, like, here's some lore about an alien species that any Star Wars fan gets is they have big tempers. And they will maim you if they do have the ability to just destroy you and rip your arms off. And we've seen Chewie and we've seen Black Krasantan and we've seen Gunji, but Kelnaka has such a reserved, tall and proud manner about him, but at the same time is like, I'm a part of this group, but I'm also not gonna be. He's the only one that's not there for the testing, right? He's not. It's almost like he's a facilitator, but he's already got his own interests and is more. And maybe that is a sign of age because he would have been presumably in the proper light and life higher public, being another long-lived species. And so it's like, I would love to just like, if I could pop in, especially during these events, and be like, what do you think about this? Because I know what Indara thinks and I know what Sol thinks, but we've seen you show kindness. I almost feel like Kalnaka is the one that's like, look, I'm not here for tests. I'm not here for your beef with the witches. I am here, however, because we don't allow kids to be sheltered and pushed around and potentially abused. And so let's keep that out. And then you guys do your thing. And I also the Wookiee culture is so based around tribes, based around children in the Bad Batch. There's that beautiful thing of Omega and Gunji touching the tree together and the Wookiee shaman saying like, children finding their own way and all this stuff. I would love to know like how as a master have you married your culture with this? And we've gotten some of that with Buri and with Arkoff too in the High Republic, and I find them to be extremely compelling as a force species. Like they're kind of the ones that it's amazing to think that there was a time pre-Disney where George said no more Wookiee Jedi. Rule that they had at Lucasfilm is that you cannot create more Wookiee Jedi. It's out of control. No more. And then as George got older, he was like, nah, never mind.
He's like,
Here's
go
Gunji.
crazy.
Yeah, so I'm fascinated by that. So that's my answer.
I love it. I love it. I think that on for my part, I think I'd love to hang out with Jackie for a day, mostly because I want to know. I feel like Jackie, she's got the tea. She knows what's going on. She's gonna be all prim and proper around her masters, but when she's with her peers, she's listening, and maybe she's saying some stuff too. And so I feel like she would be fun to hang out with. We would go and, I don't know, hit the cafeteria in the Jedi Temple, and she'd tell me what's going on and be cool. She'd show me around. Be great.
Make
My
fun of
answer's a
your
lot shorter. Yes, exactly. My answer's a
art.
lot shorter than yours because I don't know. Just gonna hang out with this Padawan for a little bit, but I love your answer too with Kelnaka. It makes me more excited to see him in coming episodes. Hopefully the next episode.
Yeah,
Love to see
hopefully.
Kelnaka fully there on the screen
Yeah.
instead of for like 2 seconds.
Yeah,
But
with his get out of my swamp.
yeah, get off my
Shrek.
lawn.
Yeah.
Old man, get off my lawn. Okay. All right, so Alden,
Yes.
where can we find you on
You can
social
find
media?
me personally at that Alden Diaz, THATALDENDIAZ. Octo Radio Star Wars Podcast has been on a little bit of a hiatus, not for any good reason, but just because it is. But there's episodes that are made. They're coming soon, I promise. But live every Friday is Anytime with Ken and Alden, our life, politics, world culture talk show to radio guys, trained radio professionals, just that are, one of my best friends and one of my mentors. He is very Kelnaka in his way. Ken Rapsack. So that's Fridays 11 Pacific to Eastern. And yeah, popping up everywhere else, playing Star Wars trivia on In a Galaxy. I'm in a Star Wars actual play RPG show called Ionized Bastards, where I play an Ithorian lawyer who is a criminal. He's a crooked lawyer, kind of like Saul Goodman, where he's the kind of character that like Greedo would hire to be his lawyer, is kind of like how I describe him. Like he's kind of like the like walks into a courtroom and like respectable people like Mon Mothma are like, oh Jesus Christ, this guy. Like that's my baby. And yeah, find me. Let's talk about Star Wars and talk about why people should relax about it sometimes.
Yeah, very much so right now. I think people should just sit back and enjoy the Acolyte and everything Starz has to offer, because, and if you don't like it, then it's just not for you right now, I suppose.
Yeah.
So come back later when it is. You can find me at A Cosmic Love on Twitter and at Rebel Risen on Instagram, and you can find our podcast at Stardust Records without the O, so Stardust for Kurds, on Twitter, and I believe we're at the same handle on Instagram. It's been a great episode. Thank you for joining us, Alden, and we'll see you all next time. Bye-bye!